Welcome to the Radio 191 FM podcast.
You're tuned in to the R1 News, your stop for news and current affairs on the airwaves. 11 to 12 weekdays here on Radio 191 FM, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Tēnā koutou I tēnei ata, kei te whakarongo mai koe ki Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. Ko Amiria toku ingoa.
Ko Zach toku ingoa.
And you're listening to the R1 News Show for Rāmere Te Rua Tekau Mai Iwa o Hongoi Ngoi on Radio 1 Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Coming up on the program I tēnei rā, Trent Smith from the University of Otago Department of Economics is joining us to discuss city economics in our weekly segment Business as Usual. Then we'll be speaking with Predator Free to Dunedin spokesperson Kimberly Collins about the problems that cats pose to Otipoti's environment and the organisation's efforts to endorse responsible cat ownership. After that, we're talking to University of Otago Associate Professor of Finance Helen Roberts about new research which suggests that those seeking retirement in Aotearoa may have to continue working for longer. Lastly, we'll have a breezy yarn with Wasin Altina Russell from Coco Lounge in our off-to-market segment where we speak to vendors from the Otago Farmers Market.
Very shortly, we have news headlines and weather, but first, here's Eric B. and Rakim with Keep the Beat. You're listening to R1 News on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi, Purutia Kia Raka.
Time on your body and mind, 'cause I'm inclined to do both.
Kia ora koutou, you're listening to the R1 News, the Ramere R1 News here on Radio 1, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. It is currently 11:07. That was Keep the Beat by Eric B and Rakim. And now we have the R1 News headlines and weather.
The R1 News headlines.
Police say an offshore source may be responsible for a string of bomb threats made to schools around Aotearoa. On Tuesday, several bomb threats to North Island schools were found to be phony. Yesterday, more than a dozen schools were similarly threatened, including schools in Queenstown and Dunstan. Police suspect the calls, which all refer to an explosive device, are coming from one person. Assistant Police Commissioner Bruce O'Brien says the calls are threatening to the degree that schools need to take them seriously. Police are not concerned that the calls are coming from overseas, but this is a distinct possibility. In 2017, similar circumstances led to an overseas caller being arrested. The government is continuing to issue oil and gas exploration permits in Taranaki, saying the climate crisis is of insufficient weight to influence the decision. In 2021, Group Students for Climate Solution sued the government over its continued permission of onshore oil and gas exploration, saying it was at odds with the government's declaration of a climate emergency, the Zero Carbon Act, and the Paris Agreement. In 2018, the government committed to no new offshore oil and gas drilling permits, but has continued to allow offshore fossil fuel exploration. One-third of kaka chicks in Te Whanganui Atara have been found with lead in their blood. The endangered native parrots are increasingly common in the capital thanks to inner-city eco-sanctuary Zealandia. However, this urban environment is home to toxins the birds haven't previously encountered, such as lead. Remarkably, kaka appear to have developed a tolerance to lead. According to a study out of the Science of Total Environmental Journal, author Edith Sturama says more research is needed to identify any longer-term impacts of lead in the bloodstream of kaka. And those are the headlines on R1 News. Now, kei te pehe te āhua o te rangi. How's the weather?
The R1 News weather.
Kia ora, these are your Ramere R1 News weather updates. I tēnei rā, Otipoti can finally expect some sun, with a high of te kaumātahi 11 and a low of toru 3. A few showers in the late afternoon and early evening, as well as some westerlies. Those classic westerlies always going around the place. Rahurue, Saturday, we have some early showers clearing by midday, with a high of iwa 9 and a low of fa 4. It is a very, very uneventful weather day tomorrow, but hey, we never know what the weather is going to do, so just be careful.
That was the R1 News headlines. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram, and tune in to R1 News at 11 a.m. on weekdays.
Those were the headlines and weather for R1 News on Friday, the 29th of July. Very shortly, we're going to be speaking with Trent Smith from the Department of Economics for our segment Business as Usual. But in the meantime, here is Inner City Pressure by Flight of the Conchords.
City pressure, the concrete world is starting to get you. The city is alive, the city is expanding. Living in the city can be demanding. You've pawned everything, everything you own. Your toothbrush jar and a camera phone. You don't know where you're going, you cross the street. You don't know why you did, you walk back across the street. Standing in the sitting room, totally skint, and your favorite jersey is covered in lint. You want to sit down, but you've sold your chair, so you just stand there. You just stand there.
From a quarter past six till a quarter to seven, the manager Bevan starts to to abuse me. Hey man, I just want some muesli. Neon signs, hidden messages, questions, answers, fetishes. You know you're not in high finance, considering secondhand underpants. Check your mind, how'd it get so bad? What happened to those other underpants you had? Look in your pockets, haven't found a cent yet. Landlines on your balls, have you paid your rent yet? Just to pay for your lessons, you're learning the flute. Ladies wouldn't pay you very much for this. Looks like you'll never be a concert flautist.
You don't measure up to the expectation. When you're unemployed, there's no vacation. No one cares, no one sympathizes. You just stay home and play synthesizers.
That was Inner City Pressure by Flight of the Conchords. It is 11:15 and you're listening to the R1 News here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. We are now joined by Trent Smith from the University of Otago's Department of Economics for our weekly installment of Business as Usual. In today's edition, we're going to be exploring urban economics. Kia ora, Trent. How's it going?
Kia ora, Miria. I'm well, thanks.
So, urban economics refers to the study of cities and the structures around urban affairs like housing, public transport, education, local government. How are economic concepts applied to these subjects, and why is it important to do that?
Yeah. The urban economics is actually incredibly complicated. Sort of, there's this massive web of interactions that happen in any big city where there are a bunch of people around. And they can be either positive or negative, right? The fact that all these people are around you, there's positive things and negative things. And so, start with the positive. Like, the reason we have cities, the reason cities formed historically is because, you know, people came together to trade, I suppose. And that's very much what happens today in cities, right? If you think about why you want to live in a city, and not everyone does, but it's easier to get a job in the city. It's either easier to find a place to, you know, study, like you and Zach here in the city. So people sort of tend to gather for those sorts of reasons. And then if you think about, like, where a business wants to locate, it's the same story, right? Like, they need customers, and the customers are all in the city, right? Once the city's established, like, that's the more and more people get drawn to it. And so that's why cities grow over time. But then there are, of course, negative things arise when a city forms, right? Suddenly there's, for example, human waste to deal with and other kinds of, potentially negative effects. Queues start to form, right? The queues get longer and longer. That's a negative effect of having more people in the city. Feel free to jump in.
Yeah. How would you say urban economics adjusts with the size or level of development in a city?
I guess honestly, the bigger the city gets, the more these sort of negative problems need to be managed, right? The more you actually need sort of some kind of mechanism for minimizing the negative effects, right? So, mm-hmm. You have to collectively come together and say, okay, we're gonna you know, install a wastewater treatment system, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But there's also just more generally, there's sort of the spatial congestion problem is pretty general. So if you just think about with transportation, right? So if you're hopping in your car and you're going to get on a busy road, right? And if it's congested enough, the fact that you pulled your car onto the road is going to slow down everyone behind you. Mm-hmm. Right? So everyone behind you, they want to get where they're going, they're going to get there one car length slower because of the fact that you got onto the road. Mm. But of course, that's a cost you're imposing on other people because of what economists would call a congestion externality. But you don't have to pay that cost, of course, right? So, and if the bigger the city and the bigger the road, the bigger the problem is, right? If you're costing people a few seconds, each person in the queue behind you on the road, you're costing them a few seconds of time, or even fractions of a second, mm-hmm. Per person. If it's 10,000 people behind you, right, that adds up, right? If you wanted to put dollar values on it, yeah, it's like real dollars. And so there are cities that have congestion pricing for road tolls and things like this. So this isn't something we worry about in Dunedin, but there are also it's also generally true that land use decisions suffer from this problem, right? So the fact that if I owned land in the middle of the city and just decided for whatever reason to leave it empty, or if I owned a building in the middle of the city to leave it empty, that's like space that can't be used for restaurants that add to the city or living spaces that would allow people to move closer to the city, that sort of thing. So it's just like my car on the road is imposing costs on people behind me, like mm-hmm. the things I do with land I own in the city or buildings I own in the city could potentially be doing the same thing, mm-hmm. right? Making the queue longer for people in some sense.
So what are some of the structures and developments that make cities more economically livable in that regard?
Like I said, these negative problems that can arise from cities, they need to be managed somehow. And this is why the field of urban planning arose, right? Was mm-hmm. that people realized, it would make sense. Like, if you want this to the city to develop and grow in a way that minimizes these negative externalities that arise, it needs to be planned, right? We should make a plan for which areas are going to grow denser and if you don't do that, you just sort of let people build their big house on a big section and off into infinity, you get urban sprawl and massive congestion and air pollution. This is Los Angeles, mm. right? And you don't want that. And honestly, Auckland obviously has a bit of that problem, right? But New Zealand, several years ago, New Zealand, We updated the Resource Management Act, and so it sort of requires local councils to deal with this problem, right? And so here in Dunedin, we've done it twice now, I guess. So we just this month, in fact, the second generation plan came into effect, and that what that's among the other things that the government tasked local councils with was finding ways to accommodate greater density near the city center, right? So I live here in Dunedin in an inner ring suburb, which this is happening to, right? So, as of this month, the like legally allowed density on my section is doubled or more, right? So the density in my neighborhood in the long term, once more building happens,
like intensify,
could intensify,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
right. Which is what you want to do from an urban planning perspective.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
As long as you do it in a way that doesn't put too much stress on infrastructure and things like this.
Now, it's interesting that you bring up Dunedin, because Otipoti is quite a fascinating case study, as, you know, we have a proportionately large student population and a quite, you know, centralized university campus, which a lot of the city is kind of built around, almost. How does the university kind of influence the city's economic structure from an urban economics kind of point of view?
So the university obviously is a large employer, but it also has all these resident customers, right? All these students that would like to live right nearby. That has a massive effect on real estate prices and rents, how rents vary in space and so forth. The closer you are to this big, this big institution of the University of Otago, the higher the rents you pay. Mm-hmm. And economists have studied this, and like in general, the price of land in cities. And so you can sort of estimate this statistically, right? Like what causes land prices or house prices to go up or down, and you can sort out all the different reasons you might expect for a house to cost more, right? Not just location, but its size and its various amenities it might have, and they've sort of worked out that like the biggest determinant of house prices, like how they vary in space, is distance from the city center. Right, and it's all about people don't want to wait in the queue. They want to be able to have access to all these urban amenities in the center,
and the culture and everything else that comes along with that.
So, given that, how could Aotearoa become a more livable city in an urban economic sense?
Well, the answer is, this is funny because I actually when I was a post grad in Santa Barbara, I actually had a research assistantship where the professor I was working for was doing research on urban economics, and my job was to like work out all the different costs, the different externalities that, mm-hmm. that are generated in a city, and to come up with like special taxes that would just be equal to like the people have to pay, that would be just equal to the cost they're imposing on everyone else in the city. And the list of the taxes you would have to like sort out and estimate and add up, it was incredibly complicated, right? Like this is the day that I realized, oh, this actually just needs urban planning. Like we need to come together, whatever, as a city and talk about this. How do we want our city to look 20 years from now?
Yeah.
And the Resource Management Act has sort of forced us to do that, which is probably a good way to do it. And honestly, we could probably do more of it. Dunedin is maybe more sprawled out than it needs to be, and it's going to grow outward if we don't maybe do more to increase density. I don't know. We'll see how the second generation plan goes for us.
True,
in the next years.
Local body elections coming up soon as well.
That's definitely going to have some impact on intensification of housing and whatnot. Thank you so much for pulling up and talking about this topic, urban economics.
Cheers.
It's fantastic. It's the crossroad between urban planning and economics. Very, very fascinating. Mm. Alrighty. It is currently 11:25 here on the Ramere Awa News program. Coming up next on the show, we have an interview with Kimberly Collins from Predator Free Dunedin about Aotearoa's cat problem and how we can promote responsible cat ownership. But before then, we've got Thundercat with Dragon Ball Durag. Keep it locked.
That was Thundercat with Dragon Ball Durag. It is 29 minutes past 11. You're listening to R1 News here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. We just heard from Trent Smith talking about urban economics in our weekly segment, Business as Usual.
Yeah, very fascinating topic. Now, just about everybody loves cats, but there is no denying that the environmental cost they inflict, especially on birds, is quite severe. Forest and Bird has reported that domestic cats kill around 1.2 million birds, native birds, annually. Last month, a consortium of animal advocacy and conservation groups, including SPCA and Predator Free Dunedin, met with the Dunedin City Council to discuss promoting responsible cat ownership in what was labelled by Forest and Bird spokesperson Kimberly Collins as the first step in controlling the cat population within the city. We now have Kimberly on the line to discuss what kind of domestic cat problems Otipoti is facing, responsible cat ownership, and what the government can do to minimise the damage that cats do. Kia ora, Kimberly. How's it going?
Kia ora. Great, thanks.
Awesome. Now, feral cats and domestic cats are harming Aotearoa's biodiversity, but they pose different threats. What kind of damage are domestic cats causing for our local wildlife here in Otipoti, Dunedin?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's no denying that cats do hunt our native species, so that includes birds and also our lizards and, in some cases, insects. Dunedin is the wildlife capital of Aotearoa, New Zealand. We've got some really amazing species living throughout our city and out on the Otago Peninsula, so we would expect that cats will be hunting and killing native birds and other species that are found across our city.
Now, what can local government do to minimise the damage that cats cause here in Dunedin?
Yeah, so we had a discussion with Dunedin City Council around the possibility of bringing in a bylaw to help manage cat responsibilities for owners. So that would look like introducing microchipping rules and also de-sexing rules and limiting the number of animals per household. But as you mentioned, we have actually had a really productive discussion with them and other groups from around Otipoti around how we can actually encourage people to be responsible cat owners, because I think inevitably what's good for our wildlife is also really good for those cats. It keeps them safe and it makes sure that the owners know that if their cat gets lost and picked up, then hey, they can microchip it, scan it, and then they know it's going to be returned to them safely.
Now, you just mentioned that meeting you had with the council last month to discuss how people can become more responsible cat owners. Beyond de-sexing and microchipping, what other kind of, ownership measures owners could have to be more responsible, cat owners?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So keeping cats at home is actually a really, really good way to protect wildlife, but it also keeps cats safe. So, the SPCA recommends that people who keep their cats at home are going to have less chance of their cats actually getting into trouble, being injured or even killed by getting hit by vehicles or, fighting with other cats or maybe ingesting toxins when they're out and about. So this is really important for our wildlife, but also for cats. We recognise that obviously not everyone's cat is going to be happy with being kept inside, but there are plenty of things people can do to help ease their cats into that. And make sure that they are happy and healthy and staying inside. And I mean, I personally don't like going out much in winter, and I can imagine the cats would enjoy the warmth themselves.
Mm. Now, I remember reading a Forest and Bird fact sheet about the damage that cats can do. And in the fact sheet, it mentioned that there are, I think, 22 cats per hectare in Aotearoa. There's quite a lot of cats. Do you know if there's been an increase in the domestic cat population over the last, say, couple of years?
No, not off the top of my head. I do know that there are around 1.2 million companion cats in Aotearoa, and that 40% of people own at least one cat. That information's come from a really great survey from Predator Free New Zealand, who recently asked people about their attitude towards cats. And, they looked at people who do own a cat and people who don't own a cat as well. And consistently, there is a lot of support for microchipping and de-sexing and limiting the number of cats that people own and also keeping their cats inside.
So there are several cities and towns in Aotearoa, such as Wellington, Auckland and Gore, which are becoming increasingly aware of the growing cat problem, cat problem in their locale, whether that's the damage they do to their wildlife or the increasing feral cat population as owners, you know, abandon their cats and these cats have nowhere else to go. Do you think there's an increase in concern and political willpower to enact legislation through central government that would give way for measures like mandatory desexing and microchipping for future cat owners?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a petition that has been launched recently, which is available on the parliamentary website around getting central legislation for cat control in the same way that we do have a Dog Control Act. We would like to see the same for cats. You know, that removes the onus for local governments to implement sort of piecemeal legislation through bylaws that, yes, solve the problem in the short term, but in the long term, you know, may not be as impactful as a central piece of legislation would be. Yeah, absolutely keen to see the government proceed with that. Back in 2017, Dunedin City Councillors actually put a remit to Local Government New Zealand pushing for that, and we're yet to hear any further development, but there was broad support from other councils around Aotearoa for that measure.
Now, lastly, I guess this is more of a communication issue. People get quite emotional about their cats, their moggies, and putting rules in place such as, you know, maybe two cats per household could be, you know, a fairly unpopular measure, regardless of how successful it may be in reducing the impact of cats on our local wildlife. What do you believe are effective ways of communicating to the public that more cat regulation is a good thing?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really valid question and an important thing to consider. Inevitably, I think the way that we all need to communicate with each other is to recognise that, as I said, what is good for wildlife is often really good for cats. This is about making sure that cats are safe, you know, at home with their whānau and not sort of out roaming, putting themselves in danger and also predating on native wildlife. Really interesting point that keeping a limit on the number of cats could be unpopular, because this research I mentioned from Predator Free New Zealand actually suggests that 61% of people are supportive of actions to be taken to limit that number. And in many situations, it's one of those bylaws where, you know, you wouldn't actively sort of seek out people that have lots of cats, but if a situation did arise where someone had, say, 30 cats cruising around their backyard, it gives local authorities the ability to step in and actually do something and take action to help the welfare of those cats, but also, you know, the impact on local communities of having, say, 30 cats wandering around the neighbourhood.
Quite a lot of cats.
It is a lot of cats.
It's a very large amount of cats. Well, thank you so much for talking to us here on R1 News, Kimberly. Have a great day.
Thanks.
That was Kimberly Collins from Predator Free Dunedin talking about responsible cat ownership and what the government can do to make sure that our wildlife is taken care of and free from the dangers that cats pose upon them. Up next on the program, we have an interview with Associate Professor of Finance Helen Roberts from the University of Otago, who's been doing research on, I guess, the trend that retiring people who are not homeowners are facing a lot of financial stress and financial inadequacy and may have to work even longer and delay their retirement. But before that, we have Dateline with Dumb for My Age. You're listening to the R1 News program here on Radio 1. Te reo, irirangi kotahi. Take care.
Ooh, ooh.
It is 20 minutes to 12 here on R1 News. Today we're Irirangi Kotahi. We just heard Dateline with Dumb for My Age, and before that we were talking with Kimberly Collins from Predator Free Dunedin about Aotearoa's cat problem and the general ownership of cats in Aotearoa.
A Guardian article that came out this Monday reports that there is a great unretirement happening across Britain as more and more people aged 50 and up are looking for work to make ends meet. New research from the University of Otago's School of Finance finds that a similar trend is taking place across Aotearoa New Zealand. The research, which is co-led by Associate Professor Helen Roberts, finds that non-homeowners have less disposable income post-retirement than homeowners. This problem is exacerbated for Māori and renters who need to work part-time or full-time just to maintain their lifestyle amidst a cost-of-living crisis, a pandemic, and a housing crisis. I spoke with Professor Roberts yesterday about how severe the problem is, what the government can do to relieve the issue, and problems with Aotearoa's superannuation scheme.
Where there's been an increase of 116,000 people in the over-50s age group working or looking for work. Now, how dire is the situation in Aotearoa, New Zealand, by comparison?
Our study looks at data from the New Zealand Stats website over 2007 to 2009, and what we see is that the financial adequacy of people going into retirement has dropped significantly, and that means that the amount of money they have to live on once they stop working is much lower than the amount of money they had while they were working, and this is particularly bad for people who don't own their own homes. And it really affects everybody in the sense that the proportion of people who have less income to live on is markedly lower after retirement than it is before retirement. So all retirees in New Zealand should be conscious of the fact that post-retirement, if you haven't saved and accumulated wealth while you're working, you're going to be subject to much lower quality of life as a result of not having as much money to live on.
Now, due to this financial adequacy problem here, like you say, it's people are going to be having to be working longer in their older age when they probably could be retiring. Do you know how much that kind of age would be being pushed back?
So it will depend on the individual, but certainly people who were in a lower income bracket during their working life, as cost of living goes up, in particular if you are a renter. So we see for people who have not purchased a house while they've been working and having to pay rent in retirement, then many people are working well into like their mid-80s. So it's becoming progressively more of a problem for people as cost of housing and in particular rental housing increases.
Now, how long of a trend would you say has this been for, that people who are seeking retirement are having to work more due to their financial adequacy, and that people in retirement may have to hold down part-time jobs just to maintain their lifestyle?
So I think our data looks 2007 to 2009, and certainly when you look at what's happened to cost of living in the last 10 years, I think there has been a significant decline in the ability of people to meet cost of living in retirement, and that's going to just increase now because of the rising cost of housing.
I mean, yeah, this plays a crucial part in being financially adequate in your older age, having housing and the cost of housing itself. Would you endorse government actions like social housing, an increase in supply for affordable medium to high-density housing as well for New Zealanders in their older age to become homeowners? Is that even a possibility?
Yeah, I think, you know, that if you have security around accommodation, it helps a lot. And knowing that you've got a fixed rent that's not going to move substantially because of changes in either ownership of property or landowners wanting to increase, you know, rent substantially, that's really important. So having a model whereby you can have warm, safe, affordable housing for people who might otherwise be subject to the costs of higher market rental rates would be one step in the right direction in terms of helping people manage cost of living as they retire.
Aside from home ownership and the cost of housing, there are many other factors that contribute to this delay in the retirement age and the detriment to the financial adequacy of our older population. You mentioned before the cost of living. Are there many other factors that come into account when this trend is occurring, such as the increase in our lifespans, which are making people having to save up more because they're going to live for longer?
Yeah, I think that's a really valid point. And certainly there is a need in New Zealand to have some sort of mandated contribution for retirement. People aren't saving for retirement. Certainly KiwiSaver has triggered a response that sees some people taking up that ability to take some of their disposable income and set it aside for when they no longer want to work. But we don't have any defined contribution plan, which means that there are still people who will work the majority of their lives and save very little and expect to live on their pension. And the problem with that is the New Zealand superannuation payment is ranked at a replacement rate of 40%, which means typically the money you receive in your pension is around 40% of what you would have been spending pre-retirement. So it's a very low level of pension relative to other OECD countries.
Yeah, you mentioned in our email chat before and just then about the 40% replacement rate. And yeah, it is one of the lowest in the OECD countries when compared to the European Union, which has a replacement rate of 68%. Why is our superannuation replacement rate so low?
So that's the level that the government is choosing to pay our pensioners, our people in retirement. And that will be determined by some measure of adequacy around current cost of living. But like most, you know, government payments, it's sort of at the minimum end of the scale rather than the mid or the high end of what typical cost of living would be for these people.
The ACT Party wants to gradually raise the superannuation age to 67. Would this negatively impact retired people who might rely on that form of social security and force them to get back into the working world?
So essentially what ACT is proposing to do is to provide an incentive for people to stay in the workplace longer by not allowing them to draw pension until they're older. So that means that the government is paying out pension to older age people. So that reduces the burden on the taxpayer to be able to meet those payouts. On the other side of that argument, of course, are the individuals who are affected, which means people who had planned to retire when they were 65, the current retirement age, are now having to manage their working lives to push out retirement and continue to accumulate savings for longer and possibly compromise quality of life, you know, if they're at the end of their working career and they're already subject to maybe some health concerns or some other issues that might not allow them to be able to work fully abled like they would have been able to, say, 10 or 20 years ago.
Do you think a more means-tested superannuation scheme, one that adjusts for someone's income, their assets and total wealth, would help more retiring people become more financially adequate?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, I mean, essentially what a means-tested retirement payment does is it says if you meet some minimum level of wealth accumulation, then you no longer receive additional benefits paid by the government. So on the one hand, that might help to alleviate the stress that the government has to continue to meet those pension payments as the working population declines, so tax income decreases and the population ages. However, it also suggests what will that minimum be, and if you're just above that minimum you miss out, then it also creates an incentive to possibly hide assets, hide wealth, or, you know, consume more during the working life and draw pension when you retire because you've used up most of your wealth while you were younger. So there are always negative incentives that come out of these sorts of policies. But certainly, if you think of people who are very wealthy, have accumulated lots of wealth because they have worked hard, then possibly, you know, there is a threshold where we might want to consider, is it necessary that they also draw down pension from the government, given the amount of wealth they have already been able to accumulate and then spend while they're no longer working? Mm-hmm. It's an interesting debate.
That was Associate Professor Helen Roberts from the University of Otago's Department of Finance talking about the trend of non-homeowners having to retire a little bit later due to their status of being financially inadequate due to a variety of things, the cost of housing, the accessibility of housing, and the cost of living crisis that's currently going on. Up next on the program, we have Off to Market with Oisin Altena-Russell from the little hot coffee spot, Coco Lounge. But before we get to that, let's play a tune. We've got I Don't Want to Grow Up by Tom Waits. You're listening to R1 News. Take care.
Well,
That was I Don't Want to Grow Up by Tom Waits. It is currently 8 minutes to 12 on R1 News. And we are now having the return of our segment Off to Market, where we hear about what's happening at the Otago Farmers Market on Saturday morning. We are joined by Olteina Russell from Cocoa Lounge, one of the regular vendors at the market. Kia ora.
Kia ora. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. Excited to be here and kind of represent Cocoa Lounge and the farmers market, get the word out to more people.
Yes, fantastic. Hopefully it's a nice day tomorrow for the farmers market. It was a beautiful day last week. Actually, absolutely perfect day for the farmers market. Now, Cocoa Lounge is a stall or you're a vendor at the farmers market, and you used to be a cafe, correct?
Yeah, so we opened the cafe December 2019. So myself and two other Otago grads were kind of umming and ahhing about what we were going to do, and we all had a bit of hospitality experience, and we had a friend that had some cacao connections, and so we just decided to kind of give it a go and open a cafe. And so we had that up until the last level four in 2021. And our lease was up at that point, and we thought, It was a good run, but we'd just take a step back and focus on wholesale and not running the cafe anymore.
Cool. And how has that been panning out, doing wholesale online and working at the farmers market?
It's been great, actually. It's been such a stress-free sort of transition. I guess most people can imagine what it's like trying to work through the last couple of years and just having that as our basis the whole time instead of kind of pre-COVID work. So it's been nice. I think we all appreciate the change, and it's been quite positive for our business as well. Cool. The farmers market just kind of represents like our community outreach at this point. So a nice way to kind of stay grounded with the kind of community and support that we came up with and began with.
Mm.
Yeah, nice. Do you want to tell us a bit about what Cocoa Lounge sells, the cacao products and all the other unique things that you guys offer?
So I think the primary product that we sell at the moment is our cacao elixirs. So we work with raw cacao, which is unprocessed cocoa. So it's a little bit different to what goes into chocolate. There's a shorter fermentation process and a shorter roasting process. So it's kept below 65 degrees at all times to still be considered raw, but processed enough to get rid of any of the nasty stuff. And so that's the basis for all of our beverages. We do currently a line of five that we call cacao elixirs with an E, like the elixir of life.
Mm-hmm. The potion?
A potion, because it really is such a potent and powerful bioactive drink.
Mm.
Cacao is fantastic. As compared to the caffeine stimulant effect that you get in a coffee. And so you have the precursors to dopamine, oxytocin, then theobromine is the kind of large chocolate kind of feel-good effect chemical that people know, and then precursor to norepinephrine. So it lifts you up. It gives you, people compare it to like a runner's high. So that's like the basis. So it's a feel-good, mood-enhancing base. And then we do a variety of combinations. So we do a pure liqueur, which is like dark 80% cacao. You've got the cocoa butter, the cocoa solids. It's rich, it's thick, it's creamy. We do a hot chocolate, a little bit lighter. None of the cocoa butter, a little bit sweeter, more approachable. That's kind of like 60% cacao. And then we do the deep mocha, Bonzo March and Mark Love, which are all variations of the hot chocolate. The Mark Love is like autumnal ginger and cinnamon with a little bit of maca rouge. And kind of Christmas mince pie is the flavor I liken it to. Then the Bonzo Matcha is a combination of hot chocolate, matcha green tea. Matcha tea, green tea, fantastic for you, delicious. And it works really well with the cacao. The mocha is, well, it is pretty self-explanatory. It's the hot chocolate with a bit of freeze-dried coffee. So you're getting the best of both worlds. Yeah, it's nice.
Absolutely delicious. What do you see as your favourite part about being at the Otago's Farmers Market every Saturday?
The community. There's something just really special about showing up. You have your regulars, your people that you know you're gonna that you know are going to be there, rain or shine. They're there for the product. You really build like a full-on relationship. I would say that you make friends there. It's great. It's such a special kind of vibe and community environment to be in.
Good social environment, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us here on the R1 News program and talking about your fantastic little stall, Coco Lounge.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Have a great day, Oisin.
Brilliant.
All right, that just about wraps up the program. What have we been talking about today, Amelia?
We've had a busy news day, hasn't it?
Been a doozy.
We started off with business as usual, and we spoke about urban economics, which was really fascinating with Trent hearing about how cities are structured and comparing the structure of Aotearoa to how it can be most effective, yeah.
And making the most of the space we have and whatnot. It seems like a lot of interlinking and kind of chain reactions almost in terms of city planning and economics. Then we had an interview with Predator Free Dunedin spokesperson Kimberly Collins around, you know, endorsing more responsible cat ownership to limit the amount of damage that cats do on our native wildlife. They kill around 1.2 million birds annually, so it seems like there's a problem there that could be solved by microchipping, de-sexing, and keeping your cats inside.
Then we also had an interview about research into the retirement age, which is changing around the world and also in Aotearoa with an increase of age for those who are renting.
Yes, and for people who generally do not own homes, as they're having to find work to maintain their lifestyle amidst, you know, a pandemic, cost of living crisis, and a inaccessible or hard to break into housing market. And just before you heard us talk to Oisin Altina Russell, who manages Coco Lounge in the Otago Farmers Market. It's a lovely little place with some delicious elixirs and hot chocolate products, or hot cacao products, I should say.
And tomorrow looks like a great day to head to the farmers market, doesn't it?
Yeah, very, very, very breezy weather, it seems like. Very, very nice weather. I hope this lasts into next week. But anyway,
Fingers crossed.
That's probably enough from us, though.
Yeah, that's been the news for Ramere the 29th of July.
Yeah, take care and remember to listen to R1 News every weekday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. Ka kite.
You've been tuned in to the R1 News, weekdays from 11 to 12 here on Radio 1 91 FM, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. Catch up at r1.co.nz/news or find us at Radio 1 91 FM on Twitter or R1 News NZ on Instagram. Stop me, oh Lord, so I wouldn't go to forget to talk.
FM podcast. All of our content lives online at r1.co.nz.